So week seven of the speaker series taking place at Arbor Gallery here in town is titled What It Means to Be Secure, in quotes, in Today's World. Big topic. And to present it, I should mention the subtitle here, and at what cost to your personal freedom, the subtitle. What it means to be secure in today's world and at what cost to your personal freedom. And to talk to us about this presentation taking place on February the 27th at Speaker Series is Derek Evans. Hi, Derek.
Good day.
Good day. Thanks for coming into the studio to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thank you for doing this.
And giving us this little pre-presentation, a little aperçu of what you're going to be talking about on the on Saturday evening. I should say that we're pre-recording this because you're going to be away around the time that we wanted to talk to you on the radio live, so this is a pre-recorded interview.
Right. It's so pre, I haven't really sorted out
exactly,
my talk
yeah,
yet.
Exactly, yeah. We're going to actually be a part of the gestation process, I guess,
there we
here.
Go.
And we'll see what you give birth to in terms of your presentation for this talk. I'm not worried at all that it's going to be something really challenging. I was just saying to you before we went on the air that, of course, you know, we're a hyper-local show here coming from Main Street in Bankley Kill, a little village of less than 2,000 people. If in case our listeners don't know, you have a background in international diplomacy and a long, long career with different organizations like CUSO and others. And you've actually negotiated with terrorists and also with the Vatican, I think you were telling me the last time, or representatives from the Vatican. So, lots of very interesting experiences internationally. And so I'm imagining that your take on what it means to be secure in today's world is going to be sort of on that level. But I was wondering, like, it does trickle down to, I mean, we're all citizens of the planet ultimately, right? And we live locally, we live regionally, we live provincially, we live nationally, and we live internationally. So it applies, I guess, right across the board.
I think so. I think my experience over the years, and I remember this being a part of my talk last year, was that really the things that I've learned in those kinds of high-level, high-stakes negotiations, whether it's in negotiating a peace treaty or something like that, entirely applies at the level of the community and even the home.
Where we live.
That is, you know, if it really matters, if it's a conflict or a dispute or a breakdown that really matters, that has something to do with who you are as a person, who you are as a family, your identity, your core relationship, it's the same dynamics. Mm-hmm. And it's the same challenges and it's the same skills that we need to develop, whether it's on an individual level or on a community level or on a national level.
That's interesting. Yeah, I guess that you would almost want it to be. I mean, you wouldn't want a different set of standards. I mean, I'm sure the stakes are higher for sure when you're talking about relationships between countries rather than a husband and wife, for example. But the stakes are still life-altering, you know, for the people concerned. So you would want it to be consistent right through the hierarchy, if we can call it that.
Well, it only works, at least in my experience, whether you're negotiating with, you know, kings or presidents or terrorists or whoever, whatever the circumstance, or popes, it only works if it's going to work in that relationship. You're only going to get somewhere if you're able to invite that individual, that leader, into some personal decision-making about what's going to matter to them. Hmm. And it's only going to work in the long run, something like a peace treaty, if you're able to encourage, nurture, generate confidence and buy-in by ordinary people on the street outside. So it has to matter in their lives. It
yes.
can't be highfalutin, grand principles of something. It has to be something that allows ordinary people like you and me to be able to look at the proposal and say, yeah, I'm going to go for that because that's going to be a better life for my children and grandchildren.
So the standard negotiating principle of finding what the self-interest is for the person involved, and not self-interest in a selfish sort of way, but what's in it for them, and, you know, in a very real, meaningful way.
You have to create a future that includes them.
There you go. That's a great phrase.
Because that's the fundamental thing and one of the big problems in all of these conflicts. And indeed, you can think of it in your own life too, I'm sure. You find yourself in a situation where you're faced, or it appears that you're faced, with a decision between us and them. Mm-hmm. Either I get my way or you... You know, or I get 60% of my way, it means you're only going to get 40.
Yes.
In effect, you know, if you put it onto a national scale of Israel and Palestine, you know, they're only going to succeed if they wipe you out of the future and vice versa.
And that's the rhetoric we usually hear coming out of that part of the country,
exactly,
of the world.
But we all experience it in our own lives too, you know.
Mm-hmm. An either-or kind of situation.
Exactly. Yeah. You're going to get your way or I'm going to get mine.
Winners and losers. Yeah. Winner take all. All of those phrases
are
very common.
And so we have to change that whole, that whole story. So I think what I'm going to be doing in this occasion, last year I introduced some of that kind of theory and just some of the basic approach that I take in negotiating, how I create the trajectory of moving from a conflict situation into a situation where people not only begin to compromise, but also begin to collaborate in creating a new future where everybody can find a place, sometimes with a new role and some challenging changes for themselves, but nevertheless, a new future that's going to be inclusive of everybody. And I told a few stories. I told a story, I think, about negotiating a peace treaty in Sri Lanka, and another story about negotiating an agreement among all of the religious leaders of the world for them to get behind the UN AIDS program.
Yes. Allowing their followers to actually use proactively effective contraception to prevent disease, for example, in the Catholic Church. That was a huge accomplishment.
Well, exactly.
Staggering.
And it's had huge results for people, for young people and communities all across the world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. And indeed, if you go into sub-Saharan Africa at this point, the most commonplace, because of that work, the most common place for people to go to get free AIDS testing to see if they're HIV positive or not is in a church.
Really?
It's a concrete way that we designed for that change to happen, was to not simply, berate people and tell them to get out of the way, but to bring it home and make them...
The gatekeepers almost.
Live out a sense of service in relation to that change.
Fantastic.
So this time, I think what I'm going to do is I'll do a little recapping briefly, but I'll try to make it kind of a part two and invite people into a deeper conversation, which we'll look at in particular, the thing that we're preoccupied with for the past number of years, but especially now, which is the whole relationship with terrorism and in particular Islam. And so we'll look at a number of situations and then draw some learnings from history, certainly, but also look at how what it means to develop a strategy as a nation, but it also applies at a community level because we're receiving people from that conflict
all
over the country.
They're coming home close. I mean, we collected just before Christmas some outerwear and snowwear for Syrian families that are arriving.
Right in this room.
So it does come close to home. I want to take a couple of steps backwards for a second, if we can, Derek, just to the point where you were saying, and you made it sound so logical and commonsensical that who would possibly challenge it. But I think for me the biggest hurdle must be letting go of the false dichotomy, to use a bit of jargon, that is, either, we win or you win, but we can't both win, like that kind of wedge approach to I was going to say problem solving, but that's an oxymoron. Not problem solving. Like, how do you get over that first hurdle when you come to a negotiation table and people are set and you can tell that they've dug in their heels. You already know their positions. What does it take to move people just into that frame of mind of being open to everybody winning or everybody seeking a solution that's going to be beneficial to everyone? Like, what is it? What does it take?
Yeah, and that's, I think, exactly what I'm going to get into in the talk.
Okay.
And there are a few things, and if it is commonsensical, then I'll be really pleased because that's going to be the litmus test. It doesn't mean it's easy, though.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of things. First of all, when I'm leading a negotiating process, I'm not laying out the grand scheme.
Mm.
I'm not inviting people into that kind of
high level
theory.
Yeah,
and here's the plan, and here's where we're going. It's going to be much more emergent in real time, to be sure. I have an idea where to go,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of it is going to be behaviorally oriented. So it's exactly what you were pointing to, Jean. That is, if you're negotiating, you know, a peace treaty in a war from a war situation, and you know, most wars are not ones that just flash out suddenly today.
Overnight.
They've usually got a generation or two at least of background to them. So they're deep seated.
Yes.
And so people are into some pretty well defined roles. They're in boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're dealing with the leadership in particularly, you know, these are people who've only seen each other as enemies all their lives. Their whole world and their relationship with the other is in a combative mode.
Right.
So I'm going to try to do some things to break that pattern, even if they're really small.
Hmm.
So, for example, in the case I gave last time, I built a negotiation. Well, when the negotiations started, the usual thing happened, the expected thing. That is, one side sets out its precondition.
Makes its statement.
Yeah, yeah. So in this case, the Tamil Tigers said that their precondition for entering into these negotiations was that they would require, so they're the ones who take it to the lofty level, they would require an independent homeland, an independent state.
Yeah.
Okay, so that puts it
way that's before the conversation can even start, right?
Yeah. the government, the prime minister of the country, makes his statement about preconditions, which is, of course, that whatever happens, and they're happy to compromise and negotiate, but the unitary nature of the Sri Lankan state will have to be preserved.
Yeah.
So basically, end of conversation.
Yes.
You know,
this is
going to be
a
usual waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, what I did was I said to them, I recognized and acknowledged that those were both really important issues, but we'll get to them. We will address them in this process.
Yeah.
But if they would indulge me, I'd like to propose that we start with something different.
So set those two positions aside for the temporarily.
Moment, just kind put
of
them thing. In the parking lot.
Okay.
And I proposed in that case that the opening round of negotiations would be on a schedule for garbage collection in the territories.
Okay.
So
that's bringing it really down to the nuts and bolts.
So it is nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
What does that do? Well, no matter how bloody-minded you and I might, or those two guys might be, I figure we can probably come to an agreement within 2 hours that garbage collection will be on Wednesdays or twice a week or whatever. You know, we're going to come to an agreement around that. It's not going to be a big deal. And indeed, we did.
Hmm. And it becomes a stepping stone to another level.
Well, what happened there? What happened was that two people who've only known each other as in open competitive conflict,
mm-hmm.
in a zero-sum game of win and lose, mm-hmm. in life and death, agreed on something. They changed the basic nature of their relationship.
Right, right, right.
Something
sounds so simple.
Something
you know.
happened there.
Yeah.
That, what I call it, was they made a deposit in the trust account.
Hmm.
Because something happened that they did which changed the nature of their relationship, however minor it was. It was something completely different than they are accustomed to. So they begin to build or see glimmers of something that's going to be different in how they're going to work together. The other thing that happened is what I said, it has to matter to the people on the street. So the people on the street, really, for the most part, after 25 years of war, they're not really preoccupied with whether they have an independent state or are part of Sri Lanka.
They probably do care more about when their garbage is going to be picked up, I bet.
Yes, because that's what really matters.
Yes, yes, everyday
life.
And
that's actually what really matters to, in particular, women and families.
Yes, yes.
And so what suddenly happens is, at the end of the day, you are able to put out a communique that says this was achieved. And the people on the street can say, I care about that. Yes. That's a good thing because nobody's picked up our garbage in years.
Yeah.
So that matters to us. So we're going to say we want more action like that. And they're going to put pressure on, again, that's going to change the behavioral relationship. Instead of leaders who are forcing things from the top down as the way that things get done, which is what a war is, now the people are saying, oh, this matters. We want this to continue. And the pressure and accountability
from the ground
begins
up.
To happen from the ground up.
Yes, yes.
So you're changing all those relationships in real terms.
That's what I was going to say earlier. I was just, the way you're describing it, you can just feel the dynamic, like the dynamic of the relationship changing, that it's, that you've changed the current of energy, the flow of energy.
Well, in that case, you know, within 3 months, the Tamil Tigers held a press conference in which they declared that they would no longer need a unitary state as an outcome of the negotiations.
Wow.
And the government then held a press conference to say they were open to all kinds of federal arrangements or whatever and so on. Yeah. And
from a series of small wins like that, I suppose. It took it probably ongoing work, to get there. Yeah.
And so as a result of that, and I had some principles. So one of the principles that I had in that negotiation was that if outside expert advisors were brought in to help the parties, it would be one advisor who would help both parties. So in that case, we came out of that situation where, you know, a new opening is made. So I proposed that some guy named Bob Ray be brought in as an advisor to both sides to suggest different forms of federal arrangements that might be pursued as a way forward.
And already you built it so that it would be a mediating role as opposed to a confrontational role.
Exactly.
With two
experts.
So,
you know, you had people's lives changing. You had, within those 3 months, all of the refugee camps were empty. All of the schools were full. There was investment beginning to happen in communities, and shops and stuff were opening because people could see a new future for their children.
Yes.
And it was a new future that was not simply forcing those leaders to make zero-sum game compromises, who's going to win, who's going to lose. They began to become involved in a new kind of negotiation, which was about how do we create a new situation that's not so much of my side from the past and so much of your side from the past, but something that's actually a new reality.
Something new.
And that we're both investing in.
Yes, beautiful.
And that maybe we can, you know, each have a place in that future.
Yes. Derek, I'm going to stop you there because this was designed to whet the appetite of people listening so that they can go on February 27th and listen to your presentation. But I have to say, you have shared with us a very tantalizing morsel of the subject that you're going to be talking about on that Saturday evening at Arbor Gallery. I really appreciate you coming in and giving us that tantalizing sample. It's really interesting. I mean, I have a ton of questions I want to ask you about it, but I don't think it would be fair to the people going to that presentation on Saturday night. So if you want to hear more about Derek Evans' experience in negotiating, and as we've just been discussing, sort of high level, low level, it's a human condition that you're really
exactly
talking about
exactly
there. Show up at Arbor Gallery, 7:30 on February 27th. The topic is what it means to be secure in today's world and at what cost to your personal freedom. And I'm sure you won't be disappointed. It's going to be a very fascinating talk, and we will be there for sure. Thanks again, Derek, for coming in and sharing this with us.
My pleasure, and thank you, Jean, for doing this every week.
Okay, our pleasure.